Hello, welcome to Greenlit, with me, the voice which belongs to Toby Earle. In each episode of Greenlit, a guest receives the thrilling news their life is to be made into a biopic, and we discuss how that story will be told. Will they star? Which moments won't make it into the adaptation? And will King Kong make an appearance? In this episode, actor and writer Emma Kenny will plot the course of this certain blockbuster. Kenny has starred in EastEnders, Father Brown and The Curse. She's written for EastEnders, Harlots and Save Me. And she's also the creator and writer of ITV's new crime drama Karen Piri, where she also plays the eponymous detective's best pal. And Kenny can identify any crisp by the rustling sound of the packet. Emma Kenny, welcome to Greenlit.
Hi, thank you. I'm glad you got my crisp talent in there.
It's a great talent. It really is. When did you first discover you could identify any crisp by the rustling sound of the packet?
I think it was a Walker's Smoky Bacon.
Yeah,
I remember it well.
A blast from the past, a smoky bacon. I was not expecting a smoky bacon. I was thinking something along the lines of like a Monster Munch or a Scampi Fries.
Oh, that's basic. No. You need to be up there with the Walkers, identifying between flavours. You can hear the shape of Monster Munch. It's easy.
Which is the loudest shape of Monster Munch? Which is the loudest flavour, rather, of Monster Munch?
Oh, the pickled onion one.
Yeah, I would have said pickled onion as well.
Yeah.
Is it beef? Because there's a beef one, isn't there? And I think it's almost a little bit ashamed of itself, I think, the beef.
It's a rare one to hear on the street, a beef Monster Munch.
I think I would really love like a Spring Watch style series with you where we just in the woods listening to sounds of crisp packets. And I think that's a lesser spotted Monster Munch. Yeah. Emma Kenny, we're going to get down to brass tacks pretty soon, but is it pronounced biopic or biopic?
Biopic. Isn't it? You've scared me now. I feel like I'm...
First question, and you're terrified.
Yeah. Biopic sounds wrong.
Fine. Biopic it is. And now, Emma, you're a writer, you're an actor. You're about to start filming the second series of Channel 4's The Curse.
Yes,
You've created and adapted from Val McDermott's novel... this new series, Karen Piri. So you've met with executives. You've met with these people who make these decisions about what to say yes to. So for your biopic, would you have that meeting in an office or a restaurant or a studio? Where would you want this meeting to take place?
I'd like to set the power balance early on in my favor. So I feel like they have to come to me. They've just got to come to my house. Maybe I'll still be in bed. You know, like, was it Faye Dunaway, maybe? Joan Crawford, who accepted her Oscar from bed.
Wow.
I like that move.
If you were to do this, would you have that, you know, that kind of, I think it was like Norma Desmond style, sort of with like the big hair, like the big hat.
Turban, yeah.
The turban, you know, and all that, and the big sort of silk dressing gowns and whatnot. Was that, would you sat up in bed, that kind of, with that look?
Yeah, like sunglasses. Or like cucumber over my eye and a face mask. Yeah, I want them to know exactly who they're dealing with early on.
Is power balance an important thing to set early on in creative relationships?
Having met commissioners and execs, yes. You got to go straight out the gate. I'm the boss here.
Right, yeah. Is this something you've learned over time? Is this something that you've come to understand?
Well, I'm slightly joking, but... because now I'm feeling nervous about what I've said. I've learned you've got to be confident and forthright and know exactly what your vision is. So my vision is extremely glamorous, and therefore I have to be in bed wearing a silk robe.
Have you ever agreed anything significant while with pieces of cucumber on your eyes?
Not yet. I see it in my future.
I mean, it's a practical logistical question. How are they getting into your home if you're in bed? Because you're not going to answer the door and say, wait there, and then go back upstairs and then get yourself ready and then go enter. Have you lobbed the keys out the window? Have you given them a set?
I feel like my personal assistant, aka my husband, is letting them in.
Fair enough. And that is a great utilization of human resources at your disposal. And again, sets the
Yeah.
power balance.
Yeah. It's all about power balance for me.
I'm so excited. If this film isn't called Power Balance, I'm not necessarily disappointed, but I'm very much looking forward to finding out how the power balance is going to work in this. Well, exciting news. Your life has been greenlit for a biopic, but how would your life be told by Hollywood or Bollywood or Nollywood? And what sort of creative control would you exercise in bringing the greatest story you know to the big screen? So it's a big first question, Ema. What's the film called?
The film is called Ema, not Emma.
Instructive title.
Yeah.
Why do you want to get that established immediately?
Well, it's something that I have to get established immediately every day with everyone I meet. So I feel like we just got to get it out there on the poster. There has been a little bit of complication in my own life around my name, in that my parents, my dad's family are Irish. My parents called me Ema, which is an Irish name. And then early on, they felt it didn't suit me because I was a baby. And Ema's quite grown up, I think, or that's what they thought. So they proceeded to call me Emma, but
Oh.
spell it Ema. when I was in my teenage years, my mum said to me, "Well, your name is actually Ema. So why don't you change it back? Why don't you start calling yourself Ema?" So I did. And then everyone I met from then on, I introduced myself to as Ema. So there's this like weird split in my life where some people know me as Ema, and well, basically my family call me Emma, but for like a really flimsy reason.
I Okay.
I know. I deal with this every
Questions.
day.
Questions. Right. So how old were you when you went back to calling yourself your actual name, Ema?
I think I was about 15, 16.
That's a substantial portion of your life.
Yeah, it's half my life.
Right. Again, so that's a substantial portion of your life. Also, your name is spelt E-M-E-R.
Yeah.
Emma is spelt
Yeah.
E-M-M-A.
Yeah.
How did you learn the alphabet? Like, what was your understanding of the alphabet?
People still call me Emma, even if they know, like, because it's phonetic, right? You know, it's not one of those Irish ones that's got all the B's and the L's and the H's. It's just E-M-E-R. So you could say Emma, right? Like, a lot of people do that.
You could, yeah, I mean, you could.
I'm trying to give my parents an excuse here because it is sort of mad behavior.
I because I think, right, it's a lovely name. So, they've made that decision, and then
Yeah.
they've sort of then gone,
Yeah, they've
oh,
backtracked.
yeah, but didn't change the name.
I know. I honestly have asked them so many times, why did you do that? And I get a different reason every time. And none of them really make very much sense.
Can you measure your friendship groups by who called you Ema and who called you Emma?
Yeah,
Can you
absolutely.
divide them?
Yeah. And it's really confusing when they sort of overlap. And like my sister, I said to her when we were in a group, it was of work people who I'd met post age 15, 16, obviously. And I said, "You've got to call me Ema because they know me as Ema." And she said, "I can't." And I said, "You've really got to." And she said, "Well, okay, if you can call your phone your banana all night, then I'll call you Ema." And I was like, "Oh, I couldn't do it." So she didn't call me Ema.
So what, your own sister doesn't call you by your real name?
No.
Have you ever considered just changing it to Emma?
But that would be Ema's. I really like Ema. Like I
I
love
like Ema
the name.
too.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I've changed it. Like my husband calls me Ema, and my sister and brother call me Emma.
But you do not accept, hang on a minute. Do you not accept Emma now? Like, if a stranger were to meet you,
Yeah.
you would not accept Emma.
No, I would correct them. I would be like, it's Ema.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is the worst mangling you've had of your name? Other than your own parents, obviously.
Amir Carney. I remember someone called me that and it just stuck in my head because it sounded so much like Amir Khan, the boxer.
Were they not trying to make that joke? They literally
maybe.
They literally just pronounced your name like that.
It's quite a bad joke.
I mean, it's not great. How are you with other people's names in terms of sort of getting them right? Do you make an extra effort more than other people? Or
yeah, no, definitely. I definitely want to say things right and pronounce them properly because I know what it feels like. And you just ask. You can just say, oh, how do I say that? Instead of just saying it wrong. To me, it's simple. And when I have a child, I'm just going to call it one name.
What, like Cher or Madonna?
Yeah, no, just one name, not even a surname.
Right, Emma, not Emma. It's big. And I'm assuming, is it kind of like, is the not in the film poster, Emma, not Emma, is that like red because it's like angry, like not Emma? Or is it kind of just like Comic Sans, haha, it's not Emma?
Yeah, I think genre-wise, it's going to be lighter. So I think we'll just go, ha, not for now. Unless we discover any inner anger during this storylining process.
I'm buckled up. I'm ready to find out. So we've got the name of the film. It's impactful and it's informative. But what's the opening scene to Emma, not Emma?
Have you seen Miss Congeniality?
Bits of it.
Okay. The opening is set in a playground and you have Gracie Hart, Sandra Bullock's character, but as a child, and she sees a boy being bullied and she goes over there and hits the bully in the face. And then the kid that is being bullied says to her, well, I don't want to be defended by a girl, and calls her a dork brain. And so she punches him in the face. Anyway, it's a great opening scene. And I feel like I want something like that. Except I'm probably the one being bullied because I was bullied really hard at school. So something from the school days in the playground, I actually had we're not allowed to call it a cross eye anymore, but I had my left eye looked inwards. And right. So I wore a patch in the playground. Uh-huh. And so I had it really hard in the playground. I feel like we need to start there.
Okay. Wow. Were you ever called a dork brain?
No, I got witch a lot though.
Witch?
Yeah, a little witch, yeah.
Is there a reason for that?
I think just the spooky eye and the patch maybe. But that would be more pirate. But, you know, you can't tell kids this stuff.
Children are idiots, aren't they? but also, like, surely, yeah, I was going to say, you know, not to make light of the situation, it's piratical, isn't it? It is, yeah. It is, you know, Captain Kenny. You know.
Maybe that's what the scene is. The kid is like calling me a witch and I'm like, it's a pirate, you dork brain, or something like that. Power balance immediately resets.
Power balance, exactly. Take charge of the situation. What if though, I don't mean to be making light of this, Emma, but what if you lifted up the eye patch and you did exert some kind of magic laser spell like out at the kid? And it wasn't actually happening, but it was you imagining.
He's imagining. Yeah, no, I like that.
Their pants explode or something.
Yeah, or like happen. Gives it a wedgie.
Super wedgie.
Yeah, my eye gives a kid a super wedgie.
That's it. I think that's very, I mean, was it bad? Were you really bullied because you had this eye patch and?
Oh yeah, like massively. But I mean, we are making light of it, right? Because it's going to be like a massive success story in the end. She finds that bully towards the end when he's a grown man and gives him another super wedgie.
When did you get it corrected? Did you get it corrected? Did it sort itself out?
Yes, I got it corrected when I was 8. I had a massive operation. It was actually quite gruesome. They popped my eyeball out of my eye and shortened the muscles and put it back in, popped it back in. And then I had to stay in bed for a few weeks, didn't have to go to school. And I got a massive cuddly toy dog as a reward that I called Squintum.
Squintum?
Yeah, Squintum.
Wow. Okay, why Squintum? I obviously squint. Why Squintum? Was it a Latin dog?
Well, the eye problem, I think it's officially called strabismus, but people called it at that point a squint. Which shouldn't make any sense to me because like squinting is more like narrowing your eyes. But anyway, my eye going it was, and so I don't know why. I went a little bit Latin with that word and ended up with a cuddly dog called Squintum.
Wow. What and how long did you have Squintum for? Did he become like a firm buddy for the rest of your childhood?
Yeah, he was like at the end of my bed for the rest of my childhood. He's actually still up at my parents' house. So
oh, bless Squintum.
Still out there.
What type of dog is Squintum?
Oh, I think he looks like a sort of like a bloodhoundy kind of dog, but he's huge. Like he's, I'd say 4 foot long.
What?
Yeah, he's like, this is the thing is that when you ask a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old, what do you want? What's the thing you want most in the world?
Yeah.
You can have anything,
Yeah.
after this big operation you've got to have. And I said, I want a 4 foot long dog called Squintum.
I love the fact they delivered. That is amazing.
Big time, yeah.
That's like a mo but you could lie on him, I'm assuming, when you were a child,
Yeah, we
little.
were like the same size. Yeah, that was sort
Yes.
of the point.
That's fantastic. And how you mentioned there about the operation, right? Gruesome,
Yeah.
gruesome op. You were 8 years old. Did you have it explained to you what was going to happen, or did your parents tell you as you went much later in life what actually happened?
They told me afterwards. I didn't know at that point, and I was really I hated needles, and they took me in, my dad took me into the hospital, and they said they gave me some pills to put me to sleep so that they could put the needles in my arm. And the pills wore off as they were putting the needles in my arm.
No.
And my dad said, I kicked the anesthesiologist away from me across the room. And my dad had to hold me down and restrain me so that they could put me under. I don't remember any of that, but that's what my dad said happened.
Did you
We're laughing
use?
again, but these are traumatic moments.
I mean, it's not funny. I just imagine it's like the anesthetologist going home, like, "How was your day, dear?" And what, an
Yeah.
8-year-old, 8-year-old kick me clean across the room. Or did you use the old laser eye, the squinty to like
Oh,
blast?
yeah. Maybe we should do that in the film. Maybe she
Yeah.
pops a laser out again.
I'm assuming you were quite pleased to have that fixed. Like, it wasn't like you felt you'd lost something, or like of yourself having had it as a kid. Did you quite pleased that it had been fixed?
No, I think I was. I mean, the weird thing was is that I didn't see differently. I don't think I felt like, because my right eye has always been stronger,
Yeah.
so it didn't feel different. It was just the way that people treated me that was different, and that was interesting because I actually think it was quite good to have a weird thing up until that point because it, I know it sounds like a cliche, but it is quite character building. You know, if people sort of look at you and go, oh. I think being a cute kid is a bad thing because it sort of sets you up for people to be nice to you. And actually, I think it's quite good to have a bit of something to you because everyone thinks you look awful.
Do you have family members who have small children, and do you kind of go, ooh, to them just to give them that like bit of character building?
them have a weird eye. Otherwise, remember they've all got like perfectly straight eyes.
Oh.
But if I hadn't had that fixed, then
Yeah.
I would never have been able to be an actor, I don't think. Or maybe I would have, but like I would have been playing different parts, that's for sure.
Pirates?
Yeah, maybe.
Did you want to act at that age? Did you know you wanted to act at that age?
No, I don't think I did, but I'm glad that we opened up the options.
Well, like, it's interesting. Do you honestly, do you think you wouldn't have got work? Do you think it would have been the option would have been closed to you because of that?
Well, it was quite dramatic, like my eye fully looked inwards.
Really, it was like really in the
Yeah,
corner kind of
it's
thing.
like it was like, proper cross eye.
Oh wow.
I
So
just
for
did
the
it.
benefit, I mean, this is great radio. I mean, but you can really go cross-eyed. That is,
Yeah, it's a talent.
it is.
But like, I'd love to see an actress with strabismus as a leading role. Maybe we need to find one for this biopic. Yeah, I think it's strabismus. I actually don't know if that's
Shall I
the
Google it? Dare I
right
Google it just in case?
medical term. I think it is. Let's hope it
I mean, and before we move on, I'm just really curious to say that you noticed people treating you differently
Yes.
afterwards. That's quite a profound thing for an 8-year-old to recognize.
Do you think?
Do you not? I mean, I don't know. I maybe I'm putting too much weight on it, but like
No, I
for an
think I'm.
8-year-old to realize that they've been treated like their appearance had caused them to be treated one way and then another.
Yeah, I
Quite
think
a
that's
thing to.
bullying though.
All right, yeah, that's true.
When you get loads of bullying and then suddenly your eyes are straight and everyone just sort of treats you normally.
Did it stop? Did it stop? Like, was it like that? Was that it? Did
Well,
it?
I actually moved school
All right.
because of it, and so I started a new school with completely straight eyes, and it was like, a big rebrand. It was like your classic movie makeover, except to a child. and surgical.
I mean, I love the fact you're going in there straight. No, nothing can stop me now. This is it. This is who I am.
It's over for you bitches. I've got straight eyes now and I'm ready.
Did you take them all down? Did they suffer? Did they really?
Why is she so angry and obsessed with the power balance? Oh, because they don't know the backstory here. They don't know how many times I've been called a cross-eyed witch.
We've got the opening scene. Definitely. And we've just referenced it there in terms of the young Ema stroke Emma Kenny.
Yeah.
But who would be cast in the lead apart from a child star with strabismus or a child Daniel Day-Lewis type star who will go method for the role? Who would be cast in the adult but lead of Ema, not Emma?
I think we need like a series of actresses because I feel like it's going to be like a lifelong, you know, story.
Right. And, nice.
All I know is I'm half Welsh, my mum's Welsh, and Catherine Zeta-Jones has to play the older me because she's like a goddess to us. If I said anything else, it would just be wrong. And Catherine doesn't need the cross eye because she's playing me older, so that's fine. And then I feel like, yeah, younger, we need to go with someone who has the eye problem. And then in the middle, I just don't know. Auditions? Let's
open
do an
auditions.
Open audition, yeah.
Would you like an unknown to play you?
I'd love an unknown because then you get a real, you know, you get to get a star making turn.
You're gonna make a kid a star. This is really nice. We've not had this before. We've not had that, like where someone actually would like to give someone else a step up into the industry. So that's
Nice. They need to put the ladder back down. They've made it to this podcast and they don't want to bring any new blood into the industry.
That's disgraceful. I know. It's a lot of A-listers get mentioned. Some less famous than other, but a lot of A-listers. Catherine Zeta-Jones is a new one as well. what does Catherine Zeta-Jones mean to you as a half Welsh person?
Oh, she's just so innately glamorous. There's a really good interview. I don't know who it's with. Maybe it's a journalist wrote about when they met her when she was doing promo for Chicago. And it's a great little quote where she walks in to a restaurant late wearing a leather trench coat in a cloud of perfume and orders a rare steak. And I'm just like, that's excellent. That's who I want to be eventually.
What did you first see her in?
Zorro.
Oh, yeah. That's a cracking film, though, isn't it?
And there's that bit, me and my sisters always reenact it, where Antonio Banderas sort of does a Z-shape sword motion in front of her clothes and her clothes fall off and her hair just covers her boobs. Me and my sisters don't do it actually down to the boobs, but, you know, and then she goes, "You are so vigorous." And it's just the way she says that word.
Does she do it? I forget. It's a long time since I've seen. Is it Legend of Zorro, the first one?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Does she do it in a Spanish Welsh accent?
I think she's just Spanish in that one. She's sort of Spanishy, American-y. I don't know if we get any Welsh, but we'll have to rewatch. I mean, Anthony Hopkins is in there too, and he's Welsh, so I'm surprised they didn't just push each other into the Welsh accent.
That's a really good point. That's a great point, in fact, because she plays his daughter.
Yeah.
Why not a Welsh Zorro? Why didn't they do a Welsh Zorro?
Well, there's an idea. Leave it with me.
Can you say Zorro in a Welsh accent? Because I was going to give it a go and I've really backed out.
Oh, I think I might offend all of my family if I try that. So I'm going to hold back. I've already said vigorous in a Spanish accent. That's offensive enough.
I really enjoyed that pronunciation, by the way. And I hear the breathiness of her character in that as well.
Thank you. It's very well practiced.
So when did you, like, you know, you want to give an unknown a chance in playing you? When did you want to become an actor, though? When did you kind of like hit upon that as kind of your dream? When did you discover it?
Definitely when I was a teenager, or maybe a bit younger. I can't remember exactly, but I just did loads. I'm one of four siblings and I've got loads of cousins. And every time there was a family gathering, I would get all of the children who were all younger than me. And we would put on plays to everyone. I mean, we would put people through plays. And that was just like what I did every single holiday. And we would do like Mission Impossible as a play.
And wow. I would like
dangle a small child from the ceiling. You know, in that like iconic Tom Cruise scene. Yeah, we would like do sort of remakes of things. So I was like pretty obsessed with storytelling from that kind of age.
I mean, how long were the plays? Can you remember? How long were the...
To me, they feel like sort of 4-hour opuses, but they're probably about 7 minutes.
And do they like... feel like 8-hour opuses to the...
yeah. Although I feel like they were always a sort of... I was sort of herding babies like around a sort of living room stage, and then they would just sort of get bored and run off. And they would all complain. They've all complained. My sister's like, oh, you used to make us do all these plays. I'm like, you loved it. You were six and you loved it. Okay.
I'm intrigued in the fact that you remade Mission Impossible with like teeny children hanging like and recreating the dangling scene with I'm assuming not a full rig either, like a full safety rig. I'm assuming it was like a scarf tied around each ankle or something like that.
Oh yeah, I think I would be like holding an ankle, my brother would be holding another ankle. And I remember one we put my tiny cousin in a suitcase and then rolled him into the middle of the room. And oh, he was there from when everyone entered at the beginning. It was like, there's one of those theater pieces where the actors are on stage. And then halfway through the piece, he would like unzip himself and surprise everyone.
That is strikingly avant-garde for such a young, like such a young cast. That is such a funny thing to do.
I was an auteur from a very young age.
Was it films that sparked that interest, or was it TV or theater?
I think that was these big blockbusters like, you know, Mission Impossible and Zorro and, you know, those kind of big American ones that we would be doing. I don't think I was quite into any TV yet.
Is there one that sort of stands out in your memories, you seeing first and thinking, God, that's incredible? Like your brain fused when you saw that film for the first time.
What, a film?
Yeah.
Calamity Jane.
I was not expecting that. I was not expecting that.
Really? What were you expecting?
I don't know. You were just riffing there on Tom Cruise and Welsh Zorro and whatnot. So I was expecting a big blockbuster. I was not expecting Doris Day.
So my great grandpa painted movie signs, and he actually lived in America for a bit. And when they used to make their own artwork for cinemas, had to sort of make their own artwork sometimes. And he was a sign painter. And then my grandma and my great aunt were like movie obsessed and like really into golden era Hollywood. And so whenever I went to my grandma's house, we would watch all of these golden era 40s and 50s musicals and movies. And Calamity Jane was like my one that I would just rewatch and rewatch and rewatch. And I think it's because that character, she does a song called Anything You Can Do, I Can Do Better.
Yes.
And it's like, you know, when you're a young girl, and I had an older brother, and it's definitely that summed up my attitude to men and life. It set the tone.
That is such a strong role model.
Yeah.
By the way, you know, it is also Calamity Jane, isn't it? Calamity Jane, sorry.
Oh, I see what you're trying to do there. Okay, got you.
Calamity Jane. It's quite hard to do that, but I try.
Yeah, you did try. Thank you.
But that's such an interesting role model to have as a girl. You say you watch all those golden ones. Did those golden era films? Did you start watching more and more and more of those films? And you know, and Doris Day, did you like follow her?
Massively. Yeah, I mean, they just feel like they're a part of the fabric of my life. I feel like they when I said to my husband something about The Sound of Music, and he'd never seen it. And I was like, how can you not have seen The Sound of Music? I don't understand. It's like a part of everything. It's part of what makes up my complete existence. And I made him watch it. And I didn't realize how long the beginning in the nunnery is.
Oh my God.
Like, he's been in this nunnery for like half an hour. And I was like, it gets really good. Don't worry. They fight off the Nazis. Okay. Stick with it.
Do you still watch those films? Do you go back to those films much? Do you have time to do that?
I watch a lot of Westerns. I'm obsessed with Westerns because my great-grandfather, the sign painter, loved Westerns and he gave that to me. I really want to make one day. So I tend to watch lots of old Westerns, especially when I'm doing, I kind of put them on in the background and do other things.
Really?
Yeah. Is that weird?
I mean, it's not, are we talking about the sort of John Wayne style era of Westerns?
Yeah, we're talking like 60s spaghetti Westerns, like Claudia Cardinale, like Catherine Ross, you know, Good, Bad, the Ugly, you know, Butch Cassidy, all of that. I don't know why. I just love them. Calamity Jane. Oh my God, of course. That's why I love them.
Yeah, there's Calamity Jane.
People are listening you idiot, it's because you're obsessed with Calamity Jane.
I also like films with men in who wear chaps. But that's interesting though, because like you like her as a strong I hate to use that phrase, sorry, as this female role model.
Yeah.
And you know, looking at your work, in example, Karen Piri.
You can see a really good through line from Calamity Jane to Karen Piri, can't you?
I think there's, you know, there's she's funny yeah. And like she doesn't take the word shit from people. Yeah.
She's in a male dominated world. Yeah. I think it's quite clear there.
So why is it you like these films about these kind of guys who are like unreconstructed quite often? I give you like the whatchamacallit, like the spaghetti Westerns are particularly intriguing in terms of their characterization, and they're quite they're quite bleak at times.
Yeah.
But why is it about these kind of men that these scenarios that you're so?
No, I think it comes from something. Well, first of all, I just sort of like them, and I can't really explain it. But if I was to sort of analyze it a bit, I think it's that I really hate that as a woman, you're sort of told the type of movie that you should like or the type of literature that you should like. And I feel like I sort of have kind of tried to go against it a little bit from when I was younger. So kind of watched loads of gangster movies, watched loads of sports movies, watched loads of Westerns, because I just kind of feel like it's sort of patronizing to think that you have to like rom-com. I love rom-com, and I'm gonna if my biopic would be a rom-com, but I kind of, you know, equally love all of the Scorsese's and the shoot 'em ups and as well. And I think, yeah, so maybe it's just a slightly kind of wanting to rebel against the stereotype in me, maybe. I don't know.
Well, I was, you know, the next question is, what genre would the film be? And budget. And so I was going to, you say it'll be a rom-com, but also you also say you want to make a Western. So
yeah.
a Western like, rom-com?
I definitely do want to make a Western at some point. Commissioners and execs out there, that's what I want to do. But I feel
before
like-
we go on, before you go on, what kind of Western are we talking? Are we talking about like a sort of Sergio Leone style Western? What kind of Western are we talking about here?
Well, you know, I don't think this is literally a pitch. I don't think anyone has properly done a female skewing Western. Like, I feel like there are Westerns out there which have great female characters, but and like Godless on Netflix kind of nearly did it with That Town Full of Women. But I think every Western that's coming out recently, it just ends up back with the men. And that's obviously because of the history. But when you go back and you read about the West, there were loads of amazing female characters. And so I'm really interested in that and doing that and kind of looking at history, the history of America, in a kind of more, I don't know, like maybe a bit more realistic, because actually it was way more diverse than it is in those movies. It was way more, there were way more women. This is literally a pitch, by the way. If I don't get a movie deal off the back of this podcast.
We're going to get you one.
Thank you.
What did you think? Did you ever watch the TV show Deadwood?
Yes, I did. I loved it. Yeah.
Calamity Jane and that.
Yeah. So gritty and real and brilliant.
Was it Robin Weigert? Was that the actor who played her?
Yeah, I can't remember her name, but I loved that. But that went really real, like really authentic, didn't it? It was quite dark.
She was an absolute state in that film.
Yeah.
She was Robin Weigert. Yeah. She
had the sort of like dirty teeth kind of
drunk, like shambles.
Yeah,
but it was amazing. She was amazing. She was absolutely captivating.
Yeah, but again, one great female character, and then a bunch of sort of men again. And I sort of think, like, there were, you know, I worked on Harlots, which was kind of a retelling of women in the Georgian era from what they called it, a whore's eye view. It was all from the prostitute's point of view. And there were loads and loads of, I think, like an insane amount of women out in the Wild West were prostitutes because it was like the only thing that you could do out there. And when you actually look at it, I don't know, I just think there are loads of untold stories that are really interesting. So that's not my biopic, but quite. But that is something that I'm into.
Hey, look, it's your world. You can have whatever you like in this world. And I interrupted you. So what genre would the film be? What genre would Emma, not Emma, be?
So I was thinking about my favourite, like, biopic-y movies. And I was thinking Postcards from the Edge and Heartburn, Carrie Fisher's and Nora Ephron's, sort of slightly embellished, slightly fictionalised. And that's the genre I want to go into. So it's like kind of rom-com, but it's also dramatic. So that's where we're heading.
What is it about the energy of those films that you like? Like Postcards from the Edge is, yeah, the troubled. She's troubled. Carrie Fisher's troubled.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know if I'm actually troubled enough to have biopic be like that. I think we might have to let the screenwriter, whoever that is, embellish and make the story more interesting, because essentially I think my life is quite boring. But they're just great movies, and they're great characters, those central female, you know, both played by Meryl Streep, and they feel quite real, and I just love them.
Could you, I know we said about giving an unknown a step up into the industry by playing a young you. What about, because you've mentioned Dubla Streep, well, could you do the whole de-aging on Streep and like
The Irishman?
Like The Irishman, and have her play you from the age of...
I don't have enough confidence in the technology.
Is that what you'd say to Meryl when Meryl comes to you and says, listen, I really want to do it, and you would say, I'm sorry, I just don't have the confidence in the technology?
Yeah, I've got to set the power balance out. She visits me in my bed and I say, I'm sorry, Meryl, I can't be in my movie.
Oh my God.
I'm going for an unknown.
Imagine auditioning Meryl Streep while you were in bed with cucumber slices over your eyes and a turban on. That would be peak.
That would present yourself as an interesting character. I mean, I think she'd understand why you require a biopic about yourself.
So you say your life's boring, but of course this is your biopic and anything can happen. Yeah. Which parts of your life would definitely have to be in Emma, not Emma?
Okay, so we definitely have to have the eye operation,
yep,
where it gets fixed, and me kicking the anesthesiologist across the room and stuff. And then I was trying to think about what the next like formative moment. It's probably when I was about 18, 19, and I didn't get into university and I didn't get into drama school. And my boyfriend cheated on me during Freshers Week at uni. And that was probably like one of the worst moments of my life. And I couldn't sleep at all. And so I would stay up all night. And that's when I started writing. And I think that's when like my life sort of got onto this track that it's on now. So it feels like one of those turning points in a movie which you need to put in. And
I mean, you say no, you don't have much drama in your life. It's like, in what space of time did those three events take place? Are we talking about
a month? Yeah, it was like September, October when I was 18, 19. I can't remember which year it was. And I got rejected from every choice on my UCAS and drama school. And this boy broke my heart into tiny pieces, and I couldn't sleep at all. Yeah, but I wrote scripts that were really bad, and they meant that I ended up writing on and being in a soap. And that, I think, could be quite a fun montage bit.
Yeah. How did you teach yourself to write scripts?
Yes. I just watched loads and loads of Gossip Girl.
Gossip Girl.
And then I wrote my own British version of Gossip Girl,
which I really should
unearth, because I don't know where that is, but I bet you it's really funny.
Wow. How was it, just like an hour long pilot type thing, or was it hot? What was
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was about teenagers in London, growing up in London. And
yes, this sounds amazing. And like, how many scripts do you think you wrote when you were suffering from insomnia?
I think just that one, but sort of it took me a while, and probably rewrote it and worked on it a bit.
It's hard.
But who knows? I'd have to go back to the tub of notebooks that I've got in my attic and revisit the heartbreak, the tear-stained pages.
Oh, bless. How long did you have insomnia for, and how did it get sorted?
I think I just probably started fancying someone else. I don't know.
Simple as that.
There's an amazing tweet somewhere which is like, the two best creative motivations are horniness or revenge. And I feel like I think that's true. I think that one was revenge on the boy. And
yeah.
Then the horniness probably came later.
What are your inspirations now for writing, dare I ask?
God, yeah, no, they're not horniness or revenge. Probably just deadlines, execs breathing down my neck.
How do you write now? Do you write through the night? Like, do you like to write at night like that through the night, or are you?
I used to. I mean, I was insane. I used to like stay up for like 4 days at a time.
Oh,
and
come
like,
on.
Yeah, no, mad. And then my mum said to me, basically, you're going to seriously damage your health if you don't find a better way to work. And I have, over the next sort of 12, 13, 14 years, worked on it. And now I can write in the day and to a deadline.
Yikes. Were you living at home with your mum and dad when you were doing that?
Yeah.
So they would see, they would know that that's what you were doing.
Yeah, they'd sort of come down to the breakfast table and I'd be in tears over an episode of Holby City.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
And there'd be like a litter of Diet Cokes and like coffee and tea around me. And they'd be like, did you stay up all night again? And I'd be like, yeah. I think the script's good though now. They've experienced all that. So honestly, when Karen Puri comes out and it's on TV and it's like, they get the win as well, because like, how far she's come from crying at the kitchen table into a Diet Coke.
Was that what powered you through the night? Did you have like a go-to food sort of package, like in terms of what you would eat and drink to get you through the night, or was it just whatever was handy?
It still is, and this happened on Karen Puri a couple of times when I had to make a deadline by the morning. A Diet Coke and a Kinder Bueno.
A Kinder Bueno?
Yeah. And sometimes a 7-Up free. I've got one here right with me right now.
Oh my gosh.
Because it doesn't have caffeine in. And sometimes the caffeine does send you insane. So you do need to pull back. I don't recommend any of this, by the way, to listeners. These are all bad choices. And the best choice is like water and sleep. Okay.
Would you have liked to gone to university?
I think now I look at it and I think the friends that people make at university are great. And I think I was just sort of working from quite a young age, and I did meet lots of amazing people through work, but I didn't get that kind of like big uni mates group ever. And I think I would have loved that, actually. Yeah, I didn't go to university. I was in EastEnders. So it's quite a different experience.
I mean,
I did make mates there as well.
There are many people who would swap university for that. They would rather say,
I'm sure there would be. But like the mates that I made at EastEnders are like Himesh Patel, who now is off making movies all the time, so I don't get to see him. So it's like a uni mate maybe would have been around more.
I mean, they can't let your friend's success split up the friendship, can you?
I'm trying. Himesh, call me.
So we know what we're having in the film, but which moments would you want on the cutting room floor? Which moments aren't going in to Ema, not Emma?
I mean, the thing is, all the bad moments and the embarrassing and sad bits, they make the best movie bits. So the stuff that's on the cutting room floor is just the really boring stuff, which is like me scrolling Instagram.
Do that a lot? Do you do that a lot?
Yeah, of course. I do. Like watching Netflix, sort of lying in a trailer in my costume, staring at the ceiling. There's a lot of that. So that's the cutting room floor is littered with me doing absolutely nothing.
What is the most uncomfortable costume you've ever worn for a role? And were you able to lie on your back, stare at the ceiling while wearing it?
Well, I was in Father Brown for 5 years and I would wear the most uncomfortable 1950s underwear that is it's absolutely awful. And actually, I remember I did a movie called Eric and Ernie.
Oh, yeah.
And I wore like real 1950s like garters and all this stuff. And there was a scene where I had to get out of a car wearing it all and a tight pencil skirt and heels. And I was holding someone's real newborn baby.
What?
For the shot. And I remember thinking, like, I was trying to swivel out of the car and it was a really low down sort of 50s convertible. I remember just thinking, I am not skilled enough for this. I should have gone to drama school.
Oh yeah, there's that famous class in drama school, exiting a 1950s car in a pencil skirt while holding a newborn baby. That is, I think that's day one.
Well, that's what you assume when you don't go, that everything, that's what you're missing.
I'm assuming the scene went okay. Like it went.
Yeah, it's in the movie. It's in the film, and the film, I think, won a BAFTA. Or well, Daniel, who played Eric, did win a BAFTA. So I didn't mess with that.
So that's not going in. But we've mentioned some of the influences on Emma Not Emma. We've heard about Calamity Jane and Zorro, but are there any other influences from TV or film or literature or comics or theatre that would bring to bear on this story?
I want Greta Gerwig to direct it.
Oh wow! Okay.
Yeah, she's signed up, and I think I want like a Nancy Meyers influence on the visuals. So I want like good fashion, nice interiors, glossy hair. And like a bit of a When Harry Met Sally influence.
Ooh.
Okay, so that's where we are.
What is When Harry Met Sally for you, like the absolute the mothership of all rom-coms?
Yeah, it's pretty good. You can't deny it. I've read it a bunch of times. It's just lovely.
Why? What do you think it does that others fail to do in terms of rom-coms?
I think it does conversation, dialogue, and character over story. And I think Nora Ephron is the queen of that and is so observational about what people talk about and what creates chemistry. And the director, is it Rob Reiner? I think it's Rob Reiner. He encouraged that. And it's like, it's just allowed to be a basically sort of character piece about two people. And that's why it's iconic. Because I think a lot of rom-coms get concerned with plot now and actually just want like pure chemistry. So that's what Emma and Emma is going to have. Emma, not Emma, not Emma and Emma.
Emma, not Emma. Come on, man. This is your own. This is the thing. You've got to make sure everyone's reinforced. It's Emma, not Emma. Like, I'm curious, like, you know, you've written a lot. You mentioned there, like, When Harry Met Sally and what it does so well. Do you get daunted when you write certain, or you know, you're approaching certain genres or any genre? Do you think about what you consider to be the very best of the best in that genre and then think, how on earth can I match that?
I mean, I think research is like your best friend if you're daunted, because if you just steep yourself in the world and you watch all of the greats, then I think you absorb some of it and you can kind of, you don't have to think so hard. You just let it flow, but you've kind of already been around the genre enough. But yeah, I would do it, you know, right from the beginning. So even when I was on Holby City, which I only wrote like one episode of, but like it was, as I explained, it was a difficult episode. But I just watched like tons and tons of ER, because I think ER is like a really brilliant medical drama, and loads of early Grey's Anatomy. Well, it had to be early because it was a long time ago. And just watched all the sort of big American medical dramas that were like, I obviously watched Holby as well, so I knew the show, but I feel like the more you can take in of other people's work, the better your work will be. And also I do think it helps you to be less daunted, because there's nothing worse than a blank page and big ideas. That's what makes people procrastinate.
How long did it take you to write Karen Piri? Because they're three 90-minute films, the adaptation of the, is it Distant Echoes, the book that it?
Yeah. I think I started writing at the end of 2018, and we started shooting in the middle of 2020. So is that what, 2.5 years?
Wow.
Is that 2.5 years?
Sounds
maybe it's 2 years. I don't know. And yeah, it took a long time. And I think I counted how many drafts. I think I wrote at least 12 of each. Ooh, each one.
Wow.
Which, when you think about that, that's like thousands of pages. And I honestly feel more sorry for Rick, because I make Rick read every script I write. That poor man. He has to answer the door to the exec, and he has to read all my scripts.
Did you make him do the voices?
I haven't ever made him read them out loud, but that is an idea.
Thousands of that, 12 drafts for each episode. There are three episodes.
Yeah. Do the maths on that.
I'd rather not.
Right now.
Yeah, I didn't go to maths university.
I didn't go to any university.
That's tough. That's tough.
Yeah, that's a lot of Kinder Bueno.
Is it what? I mean, we're going to get some, I really hope we're going to get some product placement here. Yeah, absolutely.
You're welcome.
Get you through this. Now, I mean, having just spoken about, right, it took 2 years to write Karen Puri, for example, and the number of drafts you did, 12 per film. If the critics love or hate Ema, not Emma, how would that affect you and your next project? Does it affect you? Does criticism?
Something, I've never had anything do that well. No, I'm joking. I'm joking. I've only ever written Karen Puri. I mean, I've obviously written on loads of things, but like Karen is the thing that I've had the most creative control over. So this will be my first experience of whether something sort of sinks or swims. But what was the question?
If are you affected by what critics say about your work?
I do this really funny thing. Rick finds it really funny. Like when I write a script, and I usually think it's awful. I mean, every time I think it's awful. And you have to send it off. And so I send it off. And then I say to Rick, it's awful. It's so bad. And then I'll reread it to myself. Like, obviously, you know, thinking over and over again, it's awful. That line is terrible. That's so bad. Just really obsessive. And then as soon as I get an email saying, Ema, this is brilliant. This is so good. I reread it to myself thinking, this is so good. Look at that line. That's amazing. I will look at it on my phone being like, that is so good. So yeah, I am massively affected by other people's opinions to probably not an admirable degree.
I like how you can take, your perspective on your own work changes the moment someone else gives you affirmation.
Totally. I don't think that's a good quality in a human. I think that's like, unbelievably, like I'm a sheep. I should just like completely back my own work, but no, I am affected by what other people say.
Has anyone given you because obviously you've worked collaboratively with a lot of other writers in the past as well, you know, you've written a lot. Has anyone sort of given you any tips, for example, about say Karen Puri and its reception in terms of what, how to handle criticism or what not to do or how to protect yourself best from, you know, whatever it might be, finding out good stuff, bad stuff?
No one's given me anything. I've got nothing. I mean, you hear of actors, I know actors who will not read any reviews, particularly if they're in theatre piece, because they say the good reviews of the bad reviews will affect your performance and the good reviews will affect your performance, and as would definitely be true of me. So just don't read any of it. But I don't know how you can spend 4 years working on something and then the reviews are coming out and you don't read them. I mean, that's so hard. I think you probably should avoid Twitter. That's probably something to avoid. But the reviews, I feel like, you know, even if I was trying not to, I know I'd wake up at like 2 a.m. and just Google them.
Well, the good news is, Ema, the film's in the can. Ema, not Emma, is in the can. Where's the premiere taking place and who's invited?
So I think because it's obviously a very personal film, it's got to be at my local cinema.
Oh,
the Odeon Camden.
Uh-huh.
But I was there quite recently and it's not looking its best. So I am a little nervous about Catherine Zeta-Jones showing up in Camden. So I'm going to need them to do a little refurb before she arrives. You know, in Odeon Leicester Square, they've got those leopard print seats.
Yep.
I'm gonna need them to do them in Camden Odeon.
Right. Okay. And will they be plush faux leopard skin seats? So they actually, if it's
well,
not
just real leopard skins. I just want to be clear. We're not going there.
No, we're not going there. No matter what the government may or may not be relaxing the rules on, we're having faux leopard skin. And it would so be plush, right? So it would be, you know, as opposed to just it being the screen print kind of thing, you know what I mean, that goes on the seat.
Oh, yeah, we want like that kind of velvet velour texture. Only the best for Catherine Zeta.
I like the idea of Catherine Zeta-Jones as like you say, this impossibly glamorous individual rocking up to a slightly sort of rough around the edges
Odeon
cinema. Yeah, I like the incongruity of it.
Maybe you're right. I think maybe just for me, I'd like them to do a refurb so I can enjoy it more. Shout out to Camdenodion. I love you. I visit you regularly. You know, I'm just thinking a little lick of paint, a little Hoover.
A Hoover. Oh, dear. What's your cinema snack of choice?
Oh, I like getting something chocolate and salted popcorn and then tipping all the chocolate into the salted popcorn. So when you eat the chocolate, it's salty.
Holy moly. What, like chocolate buttons or what kind of chocolate?
Yeah, I would go a button, a minstrel. I mean, any chocolate works really.
Oh, wow. I've never done that.
Sipa from The Curse, he plays my husband. He saw me do that in the cinema and was like, what are you doing? And I was like, just trust me. And now he's converted.
All right. I'm intrigued.
Well, next time you go.
Yeah.
Give it a go.
I will give it a go.
Salty chocolate is all the rage. I feel like all the chocolate bars have sort of salty bits now.
And when you go to the supermarket, can you buy chocolate salt? No, I don't think you can. Like one-way traffic, isn't it? One-way traffic. I just want to go in and get some table salt with chocolate in. What's so hard? Everything else has got salt in these days.
Good point.
And in terms of who's invited to the premiere, obviously cast and whatnot, friends, family.
The guest of honor is Professor David Taylor, who did my eye operation when I was 8.
Oh, wow.
I think we should get him on stage.
Oh, yes.
The stage at the Odeon Camden, which I don't think we're building.
That's a lovely tribute. I mean, yeah. Catherine's made she's made the journey.
And Michael Douglas will be there.
Oh, wow. Michael Douglas as well. I like Michael Douglas coming along as well. Can you see him in Camden? Can you see him just pouring his minstrels into his top?
I'd love that, wouldn't you?
I would really like to see that. I would be watching that more than I would probably watch the film, to be perfectly honest with you. I was watching him trying to kind of get all the little minstrel chocolatey goodness out of the thing. Well, there we have it. Ema, not Emma. Featuring Calamity Jane, Cal Emma T. Jane, Welsh Zorro, Kicking Anesiologist, Squintum the Dog, Laser Eyes, a Super Wedgie, Catherine Zeta-Jones, a Dork Brain, Professor David Taylor, Diet Coke, and Kinder Bueno. Ema Kenny, congratulations on being greenlit.
Oh, thank you so much. It feels very good.